gleam of salt is well documented. The Swedes had a wealth of herring, but nothing with which to salt it. One of the major commercial uses of salt in the 13th and 14th centuries was to preserve herring, second only to salt cod in the European Lenten diet. Herring was such a dominant fish in the medieval market that in 12th century Paris, saltwater fish dealers were called herringers, herring sellers. Herring is a clupeidae, a member of the same family of small, forked-tailed oily fish with a single dorsal fin as sardines. Anchovies are of a different family, but of the same clupeiform order as sardines and herring. Even in ancient times, Mediterraneans knew about herring, though they may not have known it as a fresh fish, since it is from northern seas. The Greeks called it elixium, from the word owls, or hals, as in Hallstatt, meaning salt. But the people of the Mediterranean world never embraced the salted herring the way they did the salted cod, probably because they had their own clupeiforms. The fact that herring became a hugely successful item of trade in the 14th century is directly related to the fact that Atlantic nations, herring producers, were gaining power in controlling markets and commerce in a way they never had before. Antwerp and Amsterdam became leading ports of Europe, far exceeding Genoa and Venice in importance. And just as salt cod became essential to the British and French navies, Dutch ships, both for war and commerce, were provisioned with salt-cured herring. Herring hide in ocean depths in winter, but in the spring until fall they rise and swim, sometimes thousands of miles, to their coastal spawning grounds. This phenomenon takes place from the Russian and Scandinavian Baltic, across the North Sea as far south as northern France, and across the Atlantic from Newfoundland to the Chesapeake Bay. Jules Michelet, the poetic 19th century historian, wrote in La Mer, "A whole living world has just risen from the depths to the surface, following the call of warmth, desire, and the light." It is a peculiarity of the English language that while most fish swim in schools, herring swim in shoals, a word of the same meaning derived from the same Anglo-Saxon root. A herring shoal consists of thousands of fish and, once located, provides an ample catch. But herring feed by gulping in seawater as they swim and filtering out minuscule zooplankton. They will search thousands of miles for these drifting beds of food, which means that a spot that had always been teeming with herring may suddenly one day be devoid of a single one, and they might not return to that spot for years. For the peoples of northern Europe who depended on herring, this could be a cataclysmic event, often blamed on the sins of the village folk. In the Middle Ages, adultery was thought to be a major cause of the herring leaving. Herring had been a leading source of food for Scandinavians and other populations on the Baltic and North Sea for thousands of years. Archaeologists have found herring bones among 5,000-year-old Danish remains. What really happened in the 13th and 14th centuries was not so much new ways of salting, nor new ways of fishing, but an increased supply of salt. This was especially important for herring because the salt had to be readily available for the fishery. Unlike the fat-free cod, herring must be salted within 24 hours of being lifted from the sea. This was an almost universally agreed upon and unviable law of herring curing. In 1424, the Count of Holland threatened to prosecute any fisherman who cured a herring that had been out of the water for more than 24 hours. There was also an invention of sorts. The standard technique for preserving fish going back to Phoenician times was to gut it, dry it, and pack it in layers with salt. In 1350, Wilhelm Bukelson, a fisherman from Zeeland, the fishing center of South Holland, or in other accounts, Wilhelm Bukes, a fish merchant in Flanders, started a practice of pickling herring in brine, fresh, with no drying at all, and therefore the fish could be cured without the risk of its fat turning rancid from exposure to the air. For centuries, Europe's powers, in their bids for control of the lowlands, paid homage to Bugelsson, the inventor of barreled herring. In 1506, Charles V, the Holy Roman Emperor, who was raised in Flanders, visited Bugelsson's grave to honor his contribution to mankind. But in truth, Bugelsson's invention ranks with Marco Polo's discovery of pasta, or even Columbus's discovery of America, as one of history's more bogus tales. At the time of Bugelsson's invention, herring already had been barreled in brine by the Scandinavians, the French, the Flemish, and the English for centuries. Nevertheless, the myth, like many myths, lived on. In 1856, Tsar Alexander II of Russia erected a monument to the memory of a 14th-century Flemish fisherman named Benckels, who he said invented barrel-packed herring and then moved to Finland, thus spreading the idea to Scandinavia. These tributes, even if factually dubious, do speak to the importance northern nations attached to barreled brine-salted herring. The booming medieval salt fish market was low-end, Lenten food for poor people. Upper-class people had their fish sped to them fresh, or if they lived too far from the water, had their royal fish ponds and holding tanks, or farmed fish such as carp. But from the 16th to the 18th centuries, an estimated 60% of all fish eaten by Europeans was cod, and a significant portion of the remaining 40% was herring. Cured herring had an even lower standing than salted cod, and it was hated by many poor people who had nothing else to eat for holy days. The French way of saying that breeding will tell is "le coq sent toujours le orang," the barrel always smells of herring. In Brittany, a rock known to romantics as the Tomb of Almanzor, the legendary tomb of a lover who was drowned at sea, was laughingly known by Breton workers as Tombeau du Hareng Sour, the Tomb of the Pickled Herring, because it was where they ate their lunch. But despite its low standing, fortunes could be made on furnishing the poor with herring. The herring was plentiful. Access to salt was the only limitation. Evaporating seawater over a fire was slow and costly, but northerners developed techniques to produce salt in gray, rainy climates. In northern Holland and southern Denmark, peat salt was made by burning peat that was impregnated with seawater. This ocean-soaked peat, known in Dutch as zelle, was dug from the tidal flats off the coast. The Dutch sometimes built temporary dikes to seal off an area while zelle was being harvested. It would be loaded on boats and carried to the mainland. In the Middle Ages, Zeeland, the ocean-pocked estuary of the Schelde River in southern Holland, was a center for peat salt. Porters would carry the sea-logged peat to huts where it was dried and burned. All that would remain would be ashes and salt. Salt water was added, and it would absorb the salt in a brine and leave behind the ashes. The brine was then evaporated. When badly made, this produced an impure product known as black salt. But it could also produce a very white, fine-grained salt if the peat was not mixed with soil and if an unscrupulous salt maker had not bulked up his crystals by deliberately adding white ashes. Good quality peat salt from the lowlands was highly valued for herring, but was expensive and produced only in small quantities. By the mid-13th century, good quality zelle was becoming hard to find and very valuable, which made peat salt even more expensive. The greedy would pilfer dikes, the earthworks that kept out the sea for peat. The one sacrosanct law of Dutch society, a nation living at sea level and below, is to preserve the dikes. Salt makers began to be seen as a threat to this critical first line of national defense, and laws were passed heavily taxing zelle, then fining anyone who dug peat within the Zeeland dikes, and in time, repressing the salt industry. Some sea salt was produced on the southern shore of England, but only in unusually dry, sunny summers. On the Danish island of Lyso, in the body of water known as the Kattegat, which lies between Denmark and Sweden, sea salt was produced by evaporating ocean water to a denser brine and then boiling it. The Finnish, too, made salt by this process, boiling down Arctic seawater near the current Russian town of Murmansk. The salt was mostly used for the productive salmon fishery of the area, but some of it was shipped by cart to Finland and Russia. The Norwegians used a similar process. Though this salt was expensive, the demand made it economically feasible. Oslo was actually a salt trading center. Olaus Magnus described how Norwegians improved upon this arduous sea salt process by pumping saltier water from sea depths by means of piping made from hollowed tree trunks. The same practice was carried out in Sweden until the 18th century. The process destroyed a great deal of forest, the source of fuel and piping, to produce only a small amount of salt. Sweden hoped to acquire an island in the Caribbean from which to produce salt, but when it finally got one, Saint Barthélemy, the amount of salt produced and shipped back to Sweden was barely enough to cure the quantity of herring destined for the island as slave food. The shortage of salt in the north was frustrating because of all the world's oceans, the cold subarctic seas have the densest schools and the greatest variety of species. Magnus wrote, "Herring can be purchased very cheaply for the supply is copious. They present themselves in such large numbers offshore that they not only burst the fishermen's nets, but when they arrive in their shoals, an axe or halberd thrust into their midst sticks firmly upright." Olaus Magnus, A Description of the Northern Peoples, 1555. The abundance of herring, combined with their method of extracting food from swallowing seawater, and the fact that they appeared to die instantly when taken from the water, led some medieval observers of natural phenomena to conclude that herring was a unique species of fish whose only nourishment was the seawater itself. Adding to their mystique, herring seem to let out a cry when they die, a high-pitched hiss, which is probably air escaping the swimming bladder. The small fish were also noted by maritime people for a phenomenon known as herring lightning, which occurred because the shoals were so dense that they reflected light. In the sea at night, its eyes shine like lamps, and what is more, when these fish are moving rapidly and the huge shoal turns back on itself, they resemble flashes of lightning in the churning water. Olaus Magnus, A Description of the Northern Peoples, 1555. A number of ways were found to preserve herring with small quantities of salt. The Dutch had their groene herringen, green herring, sometimes called new herring, which was gutted on board ship in early spring or late fall, before or after spawning. The herring were deboned, but the gallbladder had to be left in the fish because it contains enzymes that cure it. Then the fish were dunked in a mild brine. They had to be eaten soon, ideally within 24 hours, so while green herring required less salt, they had limited trading value. For both meat and fish, smoking was a northern solution to a lack of salt. Salt is needed for smoking, but in smaller quantities, because the smoking aids in conservation. The origin of smoking is unknown. The Romans smoked cheeses and ate Westphalian ham, which was smoked. It is not known when the first fish was smoked. In the 1960s, a Polish archaeologist found a fish smoking station in the area of Schnin, which he dated from between the 8th and 10th centuries. The Celts and Germans did not lack salt, yet they smoked their hams because cold winters forced food to be enclosed in fire-warmed rooms. Smoked foods almost always carry with them legends about their having been created by accident. Usually the peasant hung the food too close to the fire, and then imagine his surprise the next morning when... Red herring, a famous export from the East Anglia region of England along the North Sea, is soaked in a brine of salt and saltpeter, and then smoked over oak and turf. The discovery of red herring was described by a native East Anglian, Thomas Nash, in 1567. He claimed that it came about when a Yarmouth fisherman with an unusually large catch hung the surplus herring on a rafter, and by chance the room had a particularly smoky fire. Imagine his surprise the next day when the white-fleshed fish had turned red as a lobster. Finnan haddie, a haddock soaked in brine and then smoked over peat and sawdust, was originally called Findon haddocks because it was made in the Scottish North Sea town of Findon, near Aberdeen. It was not commercialized until the mid-18th century, though it may have been a household product for a long time before that. Despite the relatively recent date, it is commonly said that Finnan haddie, too, was originally made accidentally by fishermen hanging their salt fish too close to the smoky peat fire in their cabin. By the 16th century, if not earlier, on the Swedish coast of the Gulf of Bothnia, the body of water between Sweden and Finland, a light cure was devised for Baltic herring, and these pickled fish became known as surströmming. The Baltic Sea, a less salty body of water than the North Sea, has leaner and smaller herring than the Atlantic and North Sea herring eaten by the British and the Dutch. In Sweden, which has both a North Sea and a Baltic coast, the fish are known by completely different names. A Baltic herring is called a strömming, and a North Sea herring is a sill. A number of Baltic languages make this distinction. Russians speak of a Baltic salaka and an Atlantic seld. A story persists in Sweden that surströmming was discovered by accident by Swedes trying to save on salt. Surströmming was a basic ration of the Swedish army in the 17th century, during the 50 years of sporadic armed conflict that is known as the 30 Years' War. It is still regulated by a medieval royal ordinance and must be made from herring caught in April and May, just before spawning. The head and entrails are removed, but the roe is kept in the herring, which is put into light brine in barrels holding 200 pounds of fish. The fish are left to ferment in the barrels for 10 to 12 weeks at a temperature between 54 and 64 degrees Fahrenheit. The third Thursday in August, the producers are allowed to put the fish on the market. Originally it was taken from the barrel, but in modern times it is canned in July. By eating time in September, the can is bulging on the top and bottom and looks ready to explode. As the can is opened, the family stands around it to get the first fumes. Nowadays, some of the younger members flee the room. The can opener digs in, and a white, milky brine fizzes out, bubbling like fermented cider and smelling like a blend of Parmesan cheese and the bilge water from an ancient fishing vessel. These potent little fish have always been shrouded in controversy because, like Roman garum, they flirtatiously hover between fermented and rotten. Like garum, though, surströmming is in truth fermented and not rotten, because the brine the fish is dipped in is sufficient to prevent putrefaction until the fermentation process takes over. If done properly, surströmming has a strong flavor, one revered by aficionados of cured fish and loathed by the less initiated. To eat surströmming, the bloated, bluish-white, little headless fish is slit in the belly and the roe removed. None but the brave eat the roe. The splayed fish is mashed hard on the spine with a fork and turned over. The bones can then be easily lifted off. The wine-colored fermented flesh inside is then placed on a buttered crisp, a Swedish cracker with mashed potatoes. Swedes use a small, long yellow fingerling potato with a floury texture, a breed designed to survive the northern winter. In the north of Sweden, onions are added, but in the south, this is regarded as an unnecessary distraction. Once properly blended with all these tastes and textures, the fish is surprisingly pleasant. The only remaining problem is how to get the smell out of the house, a lingering odor that suggests the question, how could such a thing possibly have been eaten? In recent years, a Swedish company tried to export Sjöströmming to the United States, but the U.S. government refused it entry on the grounds that it was rotten. The more usual way of preserving fish required a great deal of salt. Herring salting was described by Simon Smith, an agent for the British government, in 1641. As soon as the herring were taken from the nets, they were passed to grippers, who gutted them and mixed them with dry salt crystals and packed them in a barrel. The barrels were then left for a day to draw out the herring juice and dissolve most of the salt. Then more salt was added and the barrel closed. According to Smith, the brine had to be dense enough for the herring to float. A barrel containing 500 to 600 herring would require 55 pints of salt. The salt shortage of the northern fisheries was solved by a commercial group that organized both herring and salt trades. Between 1250 and 1350, a grouping of small associations in northern German cities formed. Known as the Hanseatic League, from the Middle High German word Hanse, meaning fellowship, these associations pooled their resources to form more powerful groups to act in their commercial interests. They stopped piracy in the Baltic, initiated quality control on traded items, established commercial laws, provided reliable nautical charts, and built lighthouses and other aids to navigation. Before the Hanseatics gained control of the northern herring trade, peat salt was often laced with ashes, and inferior, even rotten herring was commonly sold. Les Mesnogiers du Paris gave this advice. Good brine-cured herring can be recognized because it is lean but with a thick back, round and green, whereas the bad ones are fat and yellow, or the backs are flat and dry. The fine, round-backed ones would be nicely displayed on the top of the barrel, and then only a few layers down the flat, dry backs. The Hanseatics guaranteed that an entire barrel was of quality. Those caught placing bad herring in the bottom of a barrel were heavily fined and forced to return the payment they received. The inferior fish were burned and not thrown back into the sea for fear other fish would eat them and become tainted. By the 14th century, the Hanseatics controlled the mouths of all the northerly flowing rivers of Central Europe from the Rhine to the Vistula. They had organizations in Iceland, in London, and as far south as the Ukraine and even in Venice. This gave them the ability to buy salt from numerous sources to supply the northern countries. In the early 14th century, the Hanseatics, realizing the low prices and light tax on Portuguese salt more than made up for the cost of transporting it a longer distance, imported Setubal white salt to trade in the Danish and Dutch fisheries. In the year 1452 alone, 200 Hanseatic ships stopped in Lekwasik to load Geron salt for the Baltic. In the 14th and 15th centuries, Fasterbo and Skaner in southern Sweden became major herring producers. They imported salt from the Hanseatic German port of Lübeck and exported their cured herring back to Lübeck to be marketed throughout Europe. All of this trade was carried on Hanseatic ships. At the height of their power in the 15th century, the Hanseatics were believed to have had at their command 40,000 vessels and 300,000 men. For a time, the Hanseatics were well appreciated as honorable merchants who ensured quality and fought against unscrupulous practices. They were known as Easterlings because they came from the East, and this is the origin of the word sterling, which meant of assured value. The Hanseatics are still honored by a street name, Esterlines Street, in the medieval port district of the Basque city of San Sebastian. But in time, they were seen as ruthless aggressors who wanted to monopolize all economic activity, and the merchant class rebelled against them. To control herring and salt was to control northern economies. In 1360, the Danes went to war with the Hanseatics over control of herring and lost. By 1403, when the Hanseatic League gained complete control of Bergen, Norway, It had achieved a monopoly on northern European production of herring and salt, but not without constant warfare with rebellious Baltic states. In 1406, the Hanseatics caught 96 British fishermen off Bergen, tied their hands and feet, and threw them overboard. Baltic herring started to vanish. Perhaps too much adultery was being committed in Baltic villages, and the North Sea catches became larger than ever. Suddenly the Stroming had vanished and the Sill abounded. This strengthened the English and the Dutch and weakened the Hanseatic League. Slowly the British and Dutch gained enough economic and military might to overwhelm the cartel. This was especially true after colonization gave them North American fisheries. But once the Hanseatic League began to fade, the Dutch and British were still in competition. Their herring fisheries, which became the European leaders, faced each other across the North Sea in Brielle on the Dutch side and Yarmouth on the English side. The seasoned arrival of the herring shoals became essential to the economies of both England and Holland. In medieval England, every spring, lookouts were posted along the important seaward points of eastern Britain to spot the arrival of the herring. The lookouts would point with a stick to indicate the direction the shoal was swimming from the first point off Crane Head in the Shetlands in early June until they reached Yarmouth in September. In Yarmouth, as early as the 14th century, the annual fair marking the end of the herring season, held from September 29th until November 10th, attracted herring merchants from the rest of Europe. Like the Venetian salt fleet, the huge Dutch herring fleet was trained as an armed naval force that fought numerous wars in Europe and the Caribbean against the British professional navy. Finally, in 1652, the British navy destroyed the Dutch herring fleet. In time, the Dutch made peace with the British. England got a Dutch king. But this still left the French, who had their own herring fleets and every intention of controlling salt and being a world power. Chapter 9. A Well-Salted Hexagon. In a 1961 speech, Charles de Gaulle, explaining the ungovernable character of the French nation, said, "Nobody can easily bring together a nation that has 265 kinds of cheese." The reason for the variety is that, given its limited area, the amalgamation that became France had a remarkable diversity of climates, topography, and cultures. The nation was slowly constructed from feudal kingdoms. It included Burgundians and Provençals, Germanic-speaking Alsatians, Celtic-speaking Bretons, Basques, and Catalans. The hexagon, as the French would come to call it, bordered the lowlands, the Rhine, the Alps, the Mediterranean, the Pyrenees, the Atlantic, and the English Channel, which the French have never called English, but simply La Manche, the sleeve, a word that refers to its long and narrow shape. The hexagon offered a wealth of salt, rock salt, brine springs, and both Mediterranean and Atlantic sea salt. The royal tables of the diverse medieval and Renaissance French kingdoms were set with huge, ornate nefs, ships, in this case jeweled vessels, holding salt. A nef was both a salt cellar and a symbol of the ship of state. Salt symbolized both health and preservation. Its message was that the ruler's health was the stability of the nation. In 1378, Charles V of France hosted a famous dinner that posed the awkward question of where to place the nef. Should it be in front of him, or by his guest Charles IV, the Prague-born Holy Roman Emperor? And what about the emperor's son, who was also joining them, King Wenceslas of Germany, who would become emperor after his father's death later that same year? It was decided that the table had to be set with three large nefs, one for each of the three monarchs. Richard II, the 14th century British monarch whose unpopularity was attributed to both his gaudy extravagance and his lackluster pursuit of the Hundred Years' War with France, had a neph on his table with figures of 8 tiny men on the ship deck, hoisting the flags of France. The unusual neph had no shortage of admirers, since Richard employed 2,000 chefs and was said to have entertained 10,000 visitors daily, most of whom stayed for dinner. In the 15th century, Jean, Duke de Berry, featured on his banquet table a gold ship that held not only salt but pepper, as well as, according to some accounts, powdered unicorn horn. Since it is doubtful that anyone has ever seen a unicorn, the powder may have been from the tusk of a narwhal, a single-horned relative of the whale. Unicorn horn was believed to be a poison antidote, which many monarchs wanted to have close by at mealtime. Some nephs contained serpent's tongue, which was actually shark's tooth for the same purpose. The compartments in nephs were frequently locked. Elaborate salt cellars in all forms, not only ships, were popular. In addition to his neph, in 1415 the Duke de Berry, a notable patron of the arts, received from the artist Paul de Limburg an agate salt cellar with gold lid and a sapphire knob with 4 pearls. In the 16th century, when things Italian were especially fashionable, Benvenuto Cellini, the Florentine High Renaissance sculptor and goldsmith, made a salt cellar for King François I of France, perennial war maker and insatiable art enthusiast. The dish of salt was held between the figure of Neptune, god of the sea, and the earth goddess. Salt between its 2 sources, sea and earth. By Neptune's knee was a temple with a tiny drawer for pepper. In addition to an elaborate salt cellar, referred to as the Great Salt, lesser salt cellars would be removed from the table and others brought out with changing courses. The Great Salt stayed by the master or host or most honored guest throughout the meal. It was considered rude, sometimes even unlucky, to touch salt with the fingers. Salt was taken from the cellar on the tip of a knife and a small pile put on the diner's plate. Some medieval and Renaissance plates had a small depression for salt. Placing salt on the table was a rich man's luxury, but all classes ate salted foods. In 1268, the Livre des Métiers, the Book of Trades, which listed the rules of the cooking profession, said that cooked meat could be kept for only 3 days unless it had been salted. Les Ménagiers de Paris gave recipes for not only salted whale, but also beef, mutton, venison, coot, an aquatic bird, goose, hare, and a great number of pork products. Although salting was often done in the home, it was usually not women's work. The medieval French, like the Chinese, believed that the presence of women could be destructive to fermentation. In France, a menstruating woman is said to be en salaison, curing in salt. It was dangerous to have a woman in a room full of fermenting food when she herself was in fermentation. It will spoil the lard, people would say. Originally, salting was a way to keep food through the winter, but by the Middle Ages, such foods were eaten year-round. In June and July, pieces of salted beef and mutton should be well cooked in water with green onions after having rested in salt from morning to evening for a day or more. Les Ménagiers de Paris, 1393. A food that typifies the French love of salted foods is the choucroute of Alsace and Lorraine. Alsace, known as Elsass in German, was part of the Holy Roman Empire, and France did not add it to its hexagon until 1697. The Alsatian language is a dialect of German. Choucroute appears to have evolved from German sauerkraut. But the French, having a resistance to acknowledging German origins in their culture, argue that the Chinese salted cabbage, and the Tartars made it, and always the favorite French source for foreign food, Catherine de' Medici might have introduced it. Catherine was a 16th-century Florentine who married the future Henri II of France and moved to his country with many Italian food ideas. In a popular French legend, superstar Sarah Bernhardt went to a Chinese restaurant in Paris and ordered choucroute. The waiter fetched the maitre d', who, with a suggestion of indignation, informed the actress, "This is a Chinese restaurant, madame." "Mais oui, monsieur," the actress supposedly replied, "choucroute is a Chinese invention." The Chinese may not have invented it. Scientists have found evidence of early hunters curing a leaf that resembled cabbage. But the Chinese have been pickling vegetables for millennia, and cabbage was one of the first vegetables used. The Romans made sauerkraut and were great cabbage enthusiasts. Cato suggested that women would live long, healthy lives if they washed their genitals in the urine of a cabbage eater. He was listened to on health matters, since in an age of short lives and high infant mortality, he lived to be over 80, and claimed to have fathered 28 sons, all of which he credited to eating cabbage with salt and vinegar. On the other side, Platina, from 15th century Cremona, had warned against it. "It is agreed that cabbage is of a warm and dry nature, and for this reason increases black bile, generates bad dreams, is not very nourishing, harms the stomach a little, and the head and eyes very much, on account of its gas, and dims the vision." The Alsatian word for choucroute, surkrut, resembles the German sauerkraut. Both words have the same meaning, sour or pickled grass. The German Princess Palatine, sister-in-law to Louis XIV, claimed to have introduced the dish to the court at Versailles. She wrote back to her sister in Germany, "I have also made Westphalian-type raw hams fashionable here. Everyone eats them now, and they also eat many of our German foods, sauerkraut and sugared cabbage, as well as cabbage with fat bacon, but it is hard to get it of good quality." She sent to Germany for cabbage seeds, but still complained that the vegetable did not grow well in sandy French soil. The closest to German soil would be the west bank of the Rhine, Alsace. The word Alsace, with the root als, may have originally meant land of salt. The rock salt of Alsace does not have a high concentration of sodium chloride, but has a considerable concentration of potassium chloride, known as potash, and in modern times the Alsatian habit of mining the potash for fertilizer and dumping the sodium chloride in the Rhine has become a major environmental issue. Until 1766, Lorraine was the independent kingdom of Lotharingia, named after the 9th-century king Lothair. Long before France acquired it, Lorraine was already famous for the richness of its brine springs, which have denser brine than in most of Germany, and have been exploited since prehistoric times. In the Salo Valley of Lorraine, salt has been produced since the time of the Celts. The Sel, whose name means salty, is a tributary of the Moselle. The Celtic salt mine had been abandoned, but in the 10th century, Lotharingians began boiling brine with wood fires. Salt could be moved along the Moselle to Alsace, Germany, and Switzerland. Choucroute, surkrut, and sauerkraut were all made with Lorraine salt. Surkrut was a dish for special occasions, weddings and state banquets. By the 16th century, a trade existed in Alsace known as a surkrutschneider. Literally sauerkraut tailors, surkrutschneiders chopped cabbage and salted it in barrels with anise seeds, bay leaves, elderberries, fennel, horseradish, savory, cloves, cumin, and other herbs and spices. Each surkrutschneider had his own secret recipe. By the early 18th century, the French had their own word for surkrut, surkrut. In 1767, encyclopedist and philosopher Denis Diderot mentioned sucrut in a letter, and finally, in 1786, on the eve of the French Revolution, the word choucroute first appeared. By then, choucroute was generally served mixed with or as a bed underneath other salted foods, and the dish was called choucroute garni. Originally it was served with salted fish, especially herring. But gradually salted fish was replaced by salted meats. An assortment of sausages and cured cuts of pork piled festively on a large platter of seasoned, salt-cured cabbage. Like wine, salt, and salted meats, choucroute was an important international trading commodity for Alsace. Sauerkraut made its notable debut off the continent in 1753, when an English doctor informed the Admiralty that it prevented scurvy. Many medieval Europeans had heeded Cato's words on the health benefit of cabbage, fashioning plasters and cough medicines from the leaves. The healing of the Holy Roman Emperor Maximilian II by application of cabbage plasters in 1569 was widely publicized. Once again, cabbage was medicine. The British Navy set up sauerkraut stores in British ports so that all Royal Navy vessels could set sail provisioned with sauerkraut. Captain James Cook had it served to his crew with every meal. At the same time, across the Channel in Paris, it remained banquet food for the royal court. Marie Antoinette, whose father was from the House of Lorraine, championed choucroute at court. This classic early 20th century recipe was little changed from that time. You can buy choucroute ready-made at the charcuterie or at a prepared food shop. But in the countryside this is difficult to find. We are giving the recipe in the simplest way possible. Take a round, well-shaped white cabbage, clean it, pulling off the green or wilted leaves, split the cabbage in quarters, and remove the thick sides that form the heart. Then cut the cabbage in slices thick as a straw and prepare the following brine. Take a small barrel that once contained white wine, clean it thoroughly, and cover the bottom with a layer of coarse salt. Then put on top of this a layer of cabbage cut into little strips. Sprinkle with juniper berries and here and there peppercorns. Press the layer in well, but without letting it break up. Add a new layer of salt, a bed of cabbage, juniper berries, and pepper, and continue taking care to press well. It takes about 2 pounds of salt for a dozen cabbages. The barrel should be only 3/4 filled. Cover the choucroute with a piece of loosely woven linen, then a wooden lid that fits completely inside the barrel. Put a 30-kilo, 66-pound, weight on the lid. If you don't have a weight, use a rock or a paving stone. Once fermentation begins, which happens after a short while, the lid drops down and becomes covered with water formed by the salt. You remove this water, but take care to leave a little on the lid. You can use the choucroute at the end of a month, but once you take some, you have to take care to wash the cloth and the lid and replace them, adding a little fresh water on the top to replace what has been taken. The fermentation gives the choucroute a bad smell, but don't worry about it, because you wash the choucroute with a little water before serving, and the bad taste vanishes. Choucroute garni. Wash the choucroute, changing the water several times, and squeeze it well in your hands. When it is drained so that no more water is in it, prepare a casserole, placing a piece of lard in the bottom. The fat side should touch the dish. Place on it a bed of choucroute, not too tightly packed, salt, pepper, juniper berries, a bit of fat from a roast, a small slice of lard maigre, a bacon-like cut of pork from the chest, a small sausage, and half a raw cervelas, a stumpy all-pork sausage, usually seasoned with garlic. The name comes from pork brains, cervelle, which are rarely included anymore. Put in another layer of choucroute, salt, pepper, juniper berries, roast fat, lard maigre, sausage, cervelas, and continue in this way until there is no more choucroute. Moisten the entire thing with a bottle of white wine and 2 glasses of stock. Cover and let cook for 5 hours over a low heat. Finally, remove the fat from the top and press hard on the choucroute with a spoon. Then place a platter over the casserole and turn it upside down so that your choucroute comes out shaped like a pâté. For 2 or 3 people, you can use 2 pounds of choucroute. It is better reheated the next day. Tante Marie, La Véritable Cuisine de Famille, Real Family Cooking, 1926. In the time of Pliny, a Roman legionnaire named Picaeus established a sea salt pond in the estuary of the Rhône to raise money to pay the salaries of the enormous Roman army fighting in Gaul. The marshy area, including the swamp known as the Camargue, was well suited to salt making. Located both on the Mediterranean and on a river that led into Gaul and later France, the Italians recognized the Rhône estuary as an ideal location for their salt making. A short distance from where the Genoese had their saline in Hyères, other Italians, especially the Tuscans, invested in salt works in the estuary of the Rhône. In the 13th century, a group of religious extremists based in the town of Albi and known as the Albigensians inspired Pope Innocent III to launch a series of crusades to cleanse the region of heretics. Asked how to recognize a heretic from a true believer, one crusader, according to legend, said, "Kill them all. God knows his own." The chaos that ensued from this approach is known as the Albigensian Wars. In 1229, Louis IX, the 15-year-old king of France, concluded a treaty to end the French campaign against the Albigensians, in which the Rhône estuary was ceded to the French crown. This gave France its Mediterranean coast, and in 1246, Louis established the first French Mediterranean port, a walled city named Aigues-Mortes, which means dead waters. These dead waters lay beyond the massive ramparts that enveloped the city, in a vast expanse of salt evaporation ponds built out into the Mediterranean. Louis wanted salt revenue to finance his dream of leading a crusade to the Middle East, which he did 2 years later. He captured an Egyptian port before being defeated and taken prisoner. For this, he has been ever after known in French history as Saint Louis. When he finally returned to France in 1254, his salt works, milky ponds where tall pink flamingos waited, were still producing salt and state revenue. In 1290, the crown bought nearby Pecay, site of the Roman works, and the two became the third largest producer of salt in the Mediterranean Sea, after Ibiza and Cyprus. This idea of Saint Louis, for Mediterranean salt works to be controlled for royal revenue, would one day grow into what would be remembered as one of the greatest disasters of French royal administration. The Mediterranean salt works shipped their product up the Rhône as far as Lyon. The salt was also carried on land routes over the mountains of Provence to nearer destinations such as Roquefort-sur-Soulzon. It is the presence of salt throughout France, along with either cows, goats, or sheep, that has made it the notoriously ungovernable land of 265 kinds of cheese. French cheesemakers were trying to be neither difficult nor original. They were all trying to preserve milk in salt so they could have a way of keeping it as a food supply. But with different traditions and climates, the salted curds came out 265 different ways. At one time, there were probably far more variations than that. The cheese made in the Aveyron, a mountainous area of dramatic rock outcropping and thin topsoil, is as old as its famous salt source. Pliny praised a cheese from these mountains above the Mediterranean coast that was probably a forerunner of the now famous Roquefort. According to a widely believed, though not well-documented legend, Charlemagne passed through the area after his disastrous Spanish campaign of 778. The monks of the nearby monastery of Saint-Gall served the Emperor Roquefort cheese, and he immediately busied himself cutting out the moldy blue parts, which he found disgusting. The monks convinced him that the blue was the best part of the cheese, an effort for which they were rewarded with the costly task of providing him with 2 wheels of Roquefort a year until his death in 814. The ancient cheese was and still is produced from milk of the sheep that graze on the rugged slopes of a hidden mountain area named after its largest town, the village of Saint-Affrique. Although Saint-Affrique has a humid climate, its soil cannot produce crops because the porous limestone rock absorbs most of the moisture. The farmers would collect the milk, curdle it with rennet, then scoop the curds by hand into molds. A powder made from grating moldy bread was sprinkled into the curds. At least since the 17th century, the mold came from a huge round bread, half wheat and half rye. Probably other breads were used earlier. The bread was stored in the same damp caves that aged the cheese, and in a few weeks it turned blue and was ground to dust for cheesemaking. The crumbs fermented in the cheese, creating bubbles, which after weeks also started to turn blue. In 1411, the French crown granted a patent declaring that only the cheese of Roquefort-sur-Solzon could be called Roquefort cheese. Roquefort-sur-Solzon was a tiny village with a few families, located by a rock mass called the Combalou Plateau. In the caves that run under the village, heat and humidity from underground springs are trapped in the rocks, but air constantly circulates from faults in the rock, creating air shaft-like tunnels called fleurines. The cheese cellars were built 100 feet into the rock in natural caves, moistened by the springs and aired by the fleurines. The environment of the cellar is cool, extremely humid, and moldy. The temperature is constant, about 45 degrees Fahrenheit, day and night all year. The rock walls, the old hand-hewn wooden beams, the wooden shelving where the cheeses are aged, all are continually slippery wet from the moisture. The rocks offer a kaleidoscope of mold and lichen patterns, and it has been discovered in modern times that this growth is essential to developing the flavor of the cheese. Again, there is the legend of a founding accident. An absent-minded shepherd boy left his lunch of cheese curd and rye bread in a cave, and weeks later discovered Roquefort cheese. Even if the legend is apocryphal, it offers a fair description of how the cheese is made. But for the cheese to be of commercial value, it needs to last for some time. The salt of Aigues-Mortes is rubbed on the top of the cheeses at the outset of aging. 24 hours later, the cheese is turned and the process repeated. The salt melts and begins to work into the cheese. Like the cheese of Parma, Roquefort becomes overly salty, and this unfairly gives the cheese a reputation for saltiness. Alexandre Balthazar Laurent Grimaud de la Reynière, the 18th century Frenchman, said to be the first food journalist, claimed that cheese was a salty snack for drinking. For those who need to provoke thirst, Roquefort cheese deserves more than any other the epithet of the drunkard's biscuit. The Basques learned how to make hams in their long war with the Celts, and then learned to market them in their long peace with the ham-loving Romans. Jambon de Bayonne, Bayonne ham, was never made in Bayonne, but was shipped from the Basque port of Bayonne at the mouth of the Adour River. It has never been clear, however, if the ham is Basque, though the Basques surprise no one by insisting that it is. Modern France has defined the famous jambon de Bayonne, which was first written about in the 6th century, as a product made in the watershed of the Adour, an area including all of French Basque land and bits of the neighboring regions of Landes, Bearn, and Bigorre. One thing is clear. The salt with which it is made is not Basque. It is from Bearn, from a village a few miles from Basque country called Salé de Bearn. Bearn Saltworks. According to medieval legend, a hunter wounded a wild boar and chased it into the marsh. By the time he found the animal lying in water, it was already preserved in salt. The brine springs of Lüneburg near Hamburg have an almost identical legend, and an ancient ham, supposedly made from the porcine discoverer, is on display in the Lüneburg town hall. throughout the watershed of the Adur, shards of pots used in salt-making have been found, and some have been dated as early as 1500 BC. Broken Roman pots have been found within walking distance of Salais de Bern. Whether or not a wounded boar ever fell in that spot in the center of Salais de Bern, the village has since salted millions of pigs. The town grew up around the mouth of a natural brine spring where a large basin was built to catch the escaping brine. The basin was edged in steps to facilitate approaching it with buckets. The earliest mention of this pool is in the 12th century, and every narrow, winding street in Salais leads to it. A town official would test the brine concentration by placing an egg in the pool. When the egg floated, salt-making could begin. One or two distributions were possible each week. Some would go to the brine basin themselves with a bucket in hand, but most families hired tiradeurs to gather the brine. The large wooden buckets they used, samon, were an official unit of measure, each holding 92 liters, 24 gallons, of salt water. In every distribution, each house was entitled to 26 samon. At the toll of the bell, the tiradeurs would run down the steps into the brine, which they scooped into their samon, and run back to their houses with this weighty 24-gallon load. They each repeated this 26 times, as quickly as possible, because they were competing with the other families, and the most concentrated brine from the bottom of the basin would be scooped up by the swiftest tiradeurs. Weaker brine took longer to evaporate, required more firewood, and so was less profitable. In front of each house was a stone well into which the tiradeurs would quickly but carefully pour the brine and then run back for more. A canal of hollowed oak trunks ran under the house to the basement salt-making shop where the brine would be boiled. The families eligible to participate in this community resource were called par prenom. A par prenom had to be a descendant of one of the original families, though no one knows exactly when these families originated or how many there were. A code was first written in the Béarnais language on November 11, 1587, when the tradition was already many centuries old. This code defined the group and stated that descendants had par prenom rights only if they resided within the ramparts of town. If a woman married a foreigner, someone from out of town, her children would only be entitled to a half portion, 13 samon, and their future descendants would receive nothing. But a man could marry an out-of-towner, and he and his heirs would receive full portions. In the 14th century, there were 200 par prenom families, but by the time of the French Revolution, Salais de Bern had 800 par prenom families. On the Mediterranean coast, west of Aigues-Mortes, in Catalan country near the Spanish border, was the fishing village of Collioure. The people of Collioure lived on selling wine and salted fish. They fished anchovies from May to October on small wooden boats that could sail over the rocks of the shallow harbor, powered by a lateen sail, a triangle of canvas gracefully draped from the mast on a crossbar at a 60-degree angle. The design dated back to the Phoenicians, but in Collioure they called their fishing boats Catalans and painted them in brilliant primary colors. In October, as the anchovy season ended, the wine harvest began on the terraced hills above the town. The wine, called Bagnol, has a dark, spicy sweetness that is a perfect counterbalance to the salted anchovies. The people of Collioure worked their patch of vineyard, cutting back the vines, preparing for the next year until the leaves and the shoots came. And then it was May, time to let the grapes grow and fish anchovies. Each family had a catalan for fishing and a patch on the hill for growing grapes. The men went to sea, and the women mended the nets and sold the catch in town.